incessant course towards the Mediterranean, received the appellation of Bosphorus, a name not less celebrated in the history than in the fables of antiquity. A crowd of temples and of votive altars, profusely scattered along its steep and woody banks, attested the unskillfulness, the terrors, and the devotion of the Grecian navigators, who, after the example of the Argonauts, explored the dangers of the inhospitable Black Sea. On these banks, tradition long preserved the memory of the Palace of Phineus, infested by the obscene harpies, and of the sylvan reign of Amycus, who defied the son of Leda to the combat of the Cestus. The straits of the Bosphorus are terminated by the Cyanean rocks, which, according to the description of the poets, had once floated on the face of the waters, and were destined by the gods to protect the entrance of the Black Sea against the eye of profane curiosity. From the Cyanean rocks to the point and harbour of Byzantium, the winding length of the Bosphorus extends about 16 miles, and its most ordinary breadth may be computed at about 1.5 miles. The new castles of Europe and Asia are constructed on either continent upon the foundations of 2 celebrated temples, of Serapis and of Jupiter Urius. The old castles, a work of the Greek emperors, command the narrowest part of the channel in a place where the opposite banks advance within 500 paces of each other. These fortresses were destroyed and strengthened by Mahomet II, when he meditated the siege of Constantinople. But the Turkish conqueror was most probably ignorant that 2,000 years before his reign, Darius had chosen the same situation to connect the 2 continents by a bridge of boats. At a small distance from the old castles, we discover the little town of Chrysopolis, or Scutari, which may almost be considered as the Asiatic suburb of Constantinople. The Bosphorus, as it begins to open into the Propontis, passes between Byzantium and Chalcedon. The latter of those cities was built by the Greeks a few years before the former, and the blindness of its founders, who overlooked the superior advantages of the opposite coast, has been stigmatized by a proverbial expression of contempt. The harbour of Constantinople, which may be considered as an arm of the Bosphorus, obtained in a very remote period the denomination of the Golden Horn. The curve which it describes might be compared to the horn of a stag, or, as it should seem with more propriety, to that of an ox. The epithet of golden was expressive of the riches which every wind wafted from the most distant countries into the secure and capacious port of Constantinople. The river Lycus, formed by the conflux of 2 little streams, pours into the harbour a perpetual supply of fresh water, which serves to cleanse the bottom and to invite the periodical shoals of fish to seek their retreat in that convenient recess. As the vicissitudes of tides are scarcely felt in those seas, the constant depth of the harbour allows goods to be landed on the quays without the assistance of boats, and it has been observed that in many places the largest vessels may rest their prows against the houses, while their sterns are floating in the water. From the mouth of the Lycus to that of the harbour, this arm of the Bosphorus is more than 7 miles in length. The entrance is about 500 yards broad, and a strong chain could be occasionally drawn across it to guard the port and city from the attack of a hostile navy. Between the Bosphorus and the Hellespont, the shores of Europe and Asia, receding on either side, enclose the Sea of Marmora, which was known to the ancients by the denomination of Propontis. The navigation from the issue of the Bosphorus to the entrance of the Hellespont is about 120 miles. Those who steer their westward course through the middle of the Propontis may at once descry the high lands of Thrace and Bithynia, and never lose sight of the lofty summit of Mount Olympus, covered with eternal snows. They leave on the left a deep gulf, at the bottom of which Nicomedia was seated, the imperial residence of Diocletian, and they pass the small islands of Cyzicus and Proconnesus before they cast anchor at Gallipoli, where the sea which separates Asia from Europe is again contracted into a narrow channel. The geographers who, with the most skillful accuracy, have surveyed the form and extent of the Hellespont, assign about 60 miles for the winding course, and about 3 miles for the ordinary breadth of those celebrated straits. But the narrowest part of the channel is found to the northward of the old Turkish castles between the cities of Sestus and Abydos. It was here that the adventurous Leander braved the passage of the flood for the possession of his mistress. It was here likewise, in a place where the distance between the opposite banks cannot exceed 500 paces, that Xerxes imposed a stupendous bridge of boats for the purpose of transporting into Europe 170 myriads of barbarians. A sea contracted within such narrow limits may seem but ill to deserve the singular epithet of broad, which Homer, as well as Orpheus, has frequently bestowed on the Hellespont. But our ideas of greatness are of a relative nature. The traveller, and especially the poet, who sailed along the Hellespont, who pursued the windings of the stream, and contemplated the rural scenery which appeared on every side to terminate the prospect, insensibly lost the remembrance of the sea, and his fancy painted those celebrated straits with all the attributes of a mighty river flowing with a swift current in the midst of a woody and inland country, and at length, through a wide mouth, discharging itself into the Aegean or archipelago. Ancient Troy, seated on an eminence at the foot of Mount Ida, overlooked the mouth of the Hellespont, which scarcely received an accession of waters from the tribute of those immortal rivulets, the Simois and Scamander. The Grecian camp had stretched 12 miles along the shore from the Sigean to the Rhaetian promontory, and the flanks of the army were guarded by the bravest chiefs who fought under the banners of Agamemnon. The first of those promontories was occupied by Achilles with his invincible Myrmidons, and the dauntless Ajax pitched his tents on the other. After Ajax had fallen a sacrifice to his disappointed pride and to the ingratitude of the Greeks, his sepulchre was erected on the ground where he had defended the navy against the rage of Jove and Hector, and the citizens of the rising town of Rhaetium celebrated his memory with divine honors. Before Constantine gave a just preference to the situation of Byzantium, he had conceived the design of erecting the seat of empire on this celebrated spot, from whence the Romans derived their fabulous origin. The extensive plain which lies below ancient Troy, towards the Rhaetian promontory and the tomb of Ajax, was first chosen for his new capital, and though the undertaking was soon relinquished, the stately remains of unfinished walls and towers attracted the notice of all who sailed through the straits of the Hellespont. We are at present qualified to view the advantageous position of Constantinople, which appears to have been formed by nature for the center and capital of a great monarchy. Situated in the 41st degree of latitude, the imperial city commanded from her 7 hills the opposite shores of Europe and Asia. The climate was healthy and temperate, the soil fertile, the harbour secure and capacious, and the approach on the side of the continent was of small extent and easy defence. The Bosphorus and the Hellespont may be considered as the 2 gates of Constantinople, and the prince who possessed those important passages could always shut them against a naval enemy and open them to the fleets of commerce. The preservation of the eastern provinces may, in some degree, be ascribed to the policy of Constantine, as the barbarians of the Black Sea, who in the preceding age had poured their armaments into the heart of the Mediterranean, soon desisted from the exercise of piracy, and despaired of forcing this insurmountable barrier. When the gates of the Hellespont and Bosphorus were shut, the capital still enjoyed within their spacious enclosure every production which could supply the wants or gratify the luxury of its numerous inhabitants. The sea coasts of Thrace and Bithynia, which languish under the weight of Turkish oppression, still exhibit a rich prospect of vineyards, of gardens, and of plentiful harvests, and the Propontis has ever been renowned for an inexhaustible store of the most exquisite fish that are taken in their stated seasons, without skill and almost without labour. But when the passages of the straits were thrown open for trade, they alternately admitted the natural and artificial riches of the north and south, of the Black Sea and of the Mediterranean. Whatever rude commodities were collected in the forests of Germany and Scythia, and far as the sources of the Tanais and the Borysthenes, whatsoever was manufactured by the skill of Europe or Asia, the corn of Egypt and the gems and spices of the farthest India, were brought by the varying winds into the port of Constantinople, which for many ages attracted the commerce of the ancient world. The prospect of beauty, of safety, and of wealth, united in a single spot, was sufficient to justify the choice of Constantine. But as some decent mixture of prodigy and fable has, in every age, been supposed to reflect a becoming majesty on the origin of great cities, the emperor was desirous of ascribing his resolution not so much to the uncertain counsels of human policy, as to the infallible and eternal decrees of divine wisdom. In one of his laws he has been careful to instruct posterity that in obedience to the commands of God he laid the everlasting foundations of Constantinople. And though he has not condescended to relate in what manner the celestial inspiration was communicated to his mind, the defect of his modest silence has been liberally supplied by the ingenuity of succeeding writers, who describe the nocturnal vision which appeared to the fancy of Constantine as he slept within the walls of Byzantium. The tutelar genius of the city, a venerable matron sinking under the weight of years and infirmities, was suddenly transformed into a blooming maid, whom his own hands adorned with all the symbols of imperial greatness. The monarch awoke, interpreted the auspicious omen, and obeyed, without hesitation, the will of heaven. The day which gave birth to a city or colony was celebrated by the Romans with such ceremonies as had been ordained by generous superstition. And though Constantine might omit some rites which savored too strongly of their pagan origin, yet he was anxious to leave a deep impression of hope and respect on the minds of the spectators. On foot, with a lance in his hand, the emperor himself led the solemn procession, and directed the line which was traced as the boundary of the destined capital, till the growing circumference was observed with astonishment by the assistants, who, at length, ventured to observe that he had already exceeded the most ample measure of a great city. "I shall still advance," replied Constantine, "till he, the invincible guide who marches before me, thinks proper to stop." Without presuming to investigate the nature or motives of this extraordinary conductor, we shall content ourselves with the more humble task of describing the extent and limits of Constantinople. In the actual state of the city, the palace and gardens of the Seraglio occupy the eastern promontory, the first of the seven hills, and cover about 150 acres of our own measure. The seat of Turkish jealousy and despotism is erected on the foundations of a Grecian republic, but it may be supposed that the Byzantines were tempted by the conveniency of the harbour to extend their habitations on that side beyond the modern limits of the Seraglio. The new walls of Constantine stretched from the port to the Propontis across the enlarged breadth of the triangle, at the distance of 15 stadia from the ancient fortification, and with the city of Byzantium they enclosed 5 of the 7 hills, which, to the eyes of those who approach Constantinople, appear to rise above each other in beautiful order. About a century after the death of the founder, the new buildings, extending on one side up the harbour and on the other along the Propontis, already covered the narrow ridge of the 6th and the broad summit of the 7th hill. The necessity of protecting those suburbs from the incessant inroads of the barbarians engaged the younger Theodosius to surround his capital with an adequate and permanent enclosure of walls. from the eastern promontory to the Golden Gate, the extreme length of Constantinople was about 3 Roman miles. The circumference measured between 10 and 11, and the surface might be computed as equal to about 2,000 English acres. It is impossible to justify the vain and credulous exaggerations of modern travellers who have sometimes stretched the limits of Constantinople over the adjacent villages of the European and even of the Asiatic coast. But the suburbs of Pera and Galata, though situated beyond the harbour, may deserve to be considered as a part of the city, and this addition may perhaps authorize the measure of a Byzantine historian, who assigns 16 Greek, about 14 Roman, miles for the circumference of his native city. Such an extent may not seem unworthy of an imperial residence. Yet Constantinople must yield to Babylon and Thebes, to ancient Rome, to London, and even to Paris. The master of the Roman world, who aspired to erect an eternal monument of the glories of his reign, could employ in the prosecution of that great work the wealth, the labor, and all that yet remained of the genius of obedient millions. Some estimate may be formed of the expense bestowed with imperial liberality on the foundation of Constantinople by the allowance of about 2,500,000 pounds for the construction of the walls, the porticos, and the aqueducts. The forests that overshadowed the shores of the Black Sea and the celebrated quarries of white marble in the little island of Proconesus supplied an inexhaustible stock of materials ready to be conveyed by the convenience of a short water carriage to the harbour of Byzantium. A multitude of labourers and artificers urged the conclusion of the work with incessant toil. But the impatience of Constantine soon discovered that, in the decline of the arts, the skill as well as numbers of his architects bore a very unequal proportion to the greatness of his designs. The magistrates of the most distant provinces were therefore directed to institute schools, to appoint professors, and by the hopes of rewards and privileges, to engage in the study and practice of architecture a sufficient number of ingenious youths who had received a liberal education. The buildings of the new city were executed by such artificers as the reign of Constantine could afford, but they were decorated by the hands of the most celebrated masters of the age of Pericles and Alexander. To revive the genius of Phidias and Lysippus surpassed indeed the power of a Roman emperor. But the immortal productions which they had bequeathed to posterity were exposed without defense to the rapacious vanity of a despot. By his commands, the cities of Greece and Asia were despoiled of their most valuable ornaments. The trophies of memorable wars, the objects of religious veneration, the most finished statues of the gods and heroes, of the sages and poets of ancient times, contributed to the splendid triumph of Constantinople, and gave occasion to the remark of the historian Cadrinus, who observes with some enthusiasm that nothing seemed wanting except the souls of the illustrious men whom these admirable monuments were intended to represent. But it is not in the city of Constantine, nor in the declining period of an empire, when the human mind was depressed by civil and religious slavery, that we should seek for the souls of Homer and of Demosthenes. During the siege of Byzantium, the conqueror had pitched his tent on the commanding eminence of the second hill. To perpetuate the memory of his success, he chose the same advantageous position for the principal forum, which appears to have been of a circular, or rather elliptical, form. The two opposite entrances formed triumphal arches. The porticos which enclosed it on every side were filled with statues, and the center of the forum was occupied by a lofty column of which a mutilated fragment is now degraded by the appellation of the burnt pillar. This column was erected on a pedestal of white marble 20 feet high and was composed of 10 pieces of porphyry, each of which measured about 10 feet in height and about 33 in circumference. On the summit of the pillar, above 120 feet from the ground, stood the colossal statue of Apollo. It was a bronze, had been transported either from Athens or from a town of Phrygia, and was supposed to be the work of Phidias. The artist had represented the god of day, or, as it was afterwards interpreted, the Emperor Constantine himself, with a scepter in his right hand, the globe of the world in his left, and a crown of rays glittering on his head. The circus, or hippodrome, was a stately building about 400 paces in length and about 100 in breadth. The space between the two mitui, or goals, were filled with statues and obelisks, and we may still remark a very singular fragment of antiquity, the bodies of 3 serpents twisted into 1 pillar of brass. Their triple heads had once supported the golden tripod, which, after the defeat of Xerxes, was consecrated in the temple of Delphi by the victorious Greeks. The beauty of the hippodrome has been long since defaced by the rude hands of the Turkish conquerors, but under the similar appellation of Atmidan, it still serves as a place of exercise for their horses. From the throne, whence the emperor viewed the Circensian games, a winding staircase descended to the palace, a magnificent edifice which scarcely yielded to the residence of Rome itself, and which, together with the dependent courts, gardens, and porticos, covered a considerable extent of ground upon the banks of the Propontis between the Hippodrome and the Church of Santa Sophia. We might likewise celebrate the baths, which still retained the name of Zeusippus, after they had been enriched by the munificence of Constantine with lofty columns, various marbles, and above 60 statues of bronze. But we should deviate from the design of this history if we attempted minutely to describe the different buildings or quarters of the city. It may be sufficient to observe that whatever could adorn the dignity of a great capital or contribute to the benefit or pleasure of its numerous inhabitants was contained within the walls of Constantinople. A particular description, composed about a century after its foundation, enumerates a capital or school of learning, a circus, 2 theatres, 8 public and 153 private baths, 52 porticos, 5 granaries, 8 aqueducts or reservoirs of water, 4 spacious halls for the meetings of the Senate or courts of justice, 14 churches, 14 palaces, and 4,388 houses, which, for their size or beauty, deserved to be distinguished from the multitude of plebeian inhabitants. The populousness of his favoured city was the next and most serious object of the attention of its founder. In the dark ages which succeeded the translation of the empire, the remote and the immediate consequences of that memorable event were strangely confounded by the vanity of the Greeks and the credulity of the Latins. It was asserted and believed that all the noble families of Rome, the Senate, and the Equestrian Order, with their innumerable attendants, had followed their emperor to the banks of the Propontis, that a spurious race of strangers and plebeians was left to possess the solitude of the ancient capital, and that the lands of Italy, long since converted into gardens, were at once deprived of cultivation and inhabitants. In the course of this history, such exaggerations will be reduced to their just value. Yet, since the growth of Constantinople cannot be ascribed to the general increase of mankind and of industry, it must be admitted that this artificial colony was raised at the expense of the ancient cities of the empire. Many opulent senators of Rome and of the eastern provinces were probably invited by Constantine to adopt for their country the fortunate spot which he had chosen for his own residence. The invitations of a master are scarcely to be distinguished from commands, and the liberality of the emperor obtained a ready and cheerful obedience. He bestowed on his favorites the palaces which he had built in the several quarters of the city, assigned them lands and pensions for the support of their dignity, and alienated the domain of Pontus and Asia to grant hereditary estates by the easy tenure of maintaining a house in the capital. But these encouragements and obligations soon became superfluous, and were gradually abolished. Wherever the seat of government is fixed, a considerable part of the public revenue will be expended by the prince himself, by his ministers, by the officers of justice, and by the domestics of the palace. The most wealthy of the provincials will be attracted by the powerful motives of interest and duty, of amusement and curiosity. A third and more numerous class of inhabitants will insensibly be formed, of servants, of artificers, and of merchants, who derive their subsistence from their own labour, and from the wants or luxury of the superior ranks. In less than a century, Constantinople disputed with Rome itself the preeminence of riches and numbers. New piles of buildings, crowded together with too little regard to health or convenience, scarcely allowed the intervals of narrow streets for the perpetual throng of men, of horses, and of carriages. The allotted space of ground was insufficient to contain the increasing people, and the additional foundations which on either side were advanced into the sea might alone have composed a very considerable city. The frequent and regular distributions of wine and oil, of corn or bread, of money or provisions, had almost exempted the poorest citizens of Rome from the necessity of labour. The magnificence of the first Caesars was in some measure imitated by the founder of Constantinople, but his liberality, however it might excite the applause of the people, has incurred the censure of posterity. A nation of legislators and conquerors might assert their claim to the harvests of Africa, which had been purchased with their blood, and it was artfully contrived by Augustus that in the enjoyment of plenty, the Romans should lose the memory of freedom. But the prodigality of Constantine could not be excused by any consideration either of public or private interest, and the annual tribute of corn imposed upon Egypt for the benefit of his new capital was applied to feed a lazy and insolent populace at the expense of the husbandman of an industrious province. Some other regulations of this emperor are less liable to blame, but they are less deserving of notice. He divided Constantinople into 14 regions or quarters, dignified the public council with the appellation of Senate, communicated to the citizens the privileges of Italy, and bestowed on the rising city the title of colony, the first and most favoured daughter of ancient Rome. The venerable parent still maintained the legal and acknowledged supremacy which was due to her age, her dignity, and to the remembrance of her former greatness. As Constantine urged the progress of the work with the impatience of a lover, the walls, the porticos, and the principal edifices were completed in a few years, or, according to another account, in a few months. But this extraordinary diligence should excite the less admiration, since many of the buildings were finished in so hasty and imperfect a manner, that under the succeeding reign they were preserved with difficulty from impending ruin. But while they displayed the vigour and freshness of youth, the founder prepared to celebrate the dedication of his city. The games and largesses which crowned the pomp of this memorable festival may easily be supposed, but there is one circumstance of a more singular and permanent nature which ought not entirely be overlooked. As often as the birthday of the city returned, the statute of Constantine, framed by his order, of gilt wood and bearing in his right hand a small image of the genius of the place, was erected on a triumphal car. The guards, carrying white tapers and clothed in their richest apparel, accompanied the solemn procession as it moved through the hippodrome. When it was opposite to the throne of the reigning emperor, he rose from his seat and with grateful reverence adored the memory of his predecessor. At the festival of the dedication, an edict, engraved on a column of marble, bestowed the title of Second, or New Rome, on the city of Constantine. but the name of Constantinople has prevailed over that honourable epithet, and after the revolution of 14 centuries still perpetuates the fame of its author. The foundation of a new capital is naturally connected with the establishment of a new form of civil and military administration. The distinct view of the complicated system of policy introduced by Diocletian, improved by Constantine, and completed by his immediate successors, may not only amuse the fancy by the singular picture of a great empire, but will tend to illustrate the secret and internal causes of its rapid decay. In the pursuit of any remarkable institution, we may be frequently led into the more early or the more recent times of the Roman history. But the proper limits of this inquiry will be included within a period of about 130 years, from the accession of Constantine to the publication of the Theodosian Code, from which, as well as from the Notitia of the East and West, we derive the most copious and authentic information of the state of the empire. This variety of objects will suspend for some time the course of the narrative, but the interruption will be censured only by those readers who are insensible to the importance of laws and manners, while they peruse, with eager curiosity, the transient intrigues of a court, or the accidental event of a battle. The manly pride of the Romans, content with substantial power, had left to the vanity of the East the forms and ceremonies of ostentatious greatness. But when they lost even the semblance of those virtues which were derived from their ancient freedom, the simplicity of Roman manners was insensibly corrupted by the stately affectation of the courts of Asia. The distinctions of personal merit and influence, so conspicuous in a republic, so feeble and obscure under a monarchy, were abolished by the despotism of the emperors, who substituted in their room a severe subordination of rank and office from the titled slaves who were seated on the steps of the throne to the meanest instruments of arbitrary power. This multitude of abject dependents was interested in the support of the actual government from the dread of a revolution which might at once confound their hopes and intercept the reward of their services. In this divine hierarchy, for such it is frequently styled, every rank was marked with the most scrupulous exactness, and its dignity was displayed in a variety of trifling and solemn ceremonies, which it was a study to learn, and a sacrilege to neglect. The purity of the Latin language was debased by adopting, in the intercourse of pride and flattery, a profusion of epithets which Tully would scarcely have understood, and which Augustus would have rejected with indignation. The principal officers of the empire were saluted even by the sovereign himself with the deceitful titles of your sincerity, your gravity, your excellency, your eminence, your sublime and wonderful magnitude, your illustrious and magnificent highness. The codicils or patents of their office were curiously emblazoned with such emblems as were best adapted to explain its nature and high dignity. The image or portrait of the reigning emperors, a triumphal car, the book of mandates placed on a table covered with a rich carpet and illuminated by 4 tapers, the allegorical figures of the provinces which they governed, or the appellations and standards of the troops whom they commanded. Some of these official ensigns were really exhibited in their hall of audience. Others preceded their pompous march whenever they appeared in public, and every circumstance of their demeanour, their dress, their ornaments, and their train was calculated to inspire a deep reverence for the representatives of supreme majesty. By a philosophic observer, the system of the Roman government might have been mistaken for a splendid theatre, filled with players of every character and degree who repeated the language and imitated the passions of their original model. All the magistrates of sufficient importance to find a place in the general state of the empire were accurately divided into 3 classes. 1. The illustrious. 2. The spectabiles, or respectable, And, 3, the clerissimi, whom we may translate by the word honourable. In the times of Roman simplicity, the last-mentioned epithet was used only as a vague expression of deference, till it became at length the peculiar and appropriated title of all who were members of the Senate, and consequently of all who, from that venerable body, were selected to govern the provinces. The vanity of those who, from their rank and office, might claim a superior, distinct above the rest of the senatorial order, was long afterwards indulged with the new appellation of respectable. But the title of illustrious was always reserved to some eminent personages who were obeyed or reverenced by the two subordinate classes. It was communicated only, 1, to the consuls and patricians, 2, to the praetorian prefects with the prefects of Rome and Constantinople, 3, to the masters general of the cavalry and the infantry, and 4, to the 7 ministers of the palace who exercised their sacred functions about the person of the emperor. Among those illustrious magistrates who were esteemed coordinate with each other, the seniority of appointment gave place to the union of dignities. By the expedient of honorary codicils, the emperors, who were fond of multiplying their favors, might sometimes gratify the vanity, though not the ambition, of impatient courtiers. As long as the Roman consuls were the first magistrates of a free state, they derived their right to power from the choice of the people. As long as the emperors condescended to disguise the servitude which they imposed, the consuls were still elected by the real or apparent suffrage of the Senate. From the reign of Diocletian, even these vestiges of liberty were abolished, and the successful candidates who were invested with the annual honors of the consulship affected to deplore the humiliating condition of their predecessors. The Scipios and the Catos had been reduced to solicit the votes of plebeians, to pass through the tedious and expensive forms of popular election, and to expose their dignity to the shame of a public refusal, while their own happier fate had reserved them for an age and government in which the rewards of virtue were assigned by the unerring wisdom of a gracious sovereign. In the epistles which the emperor addressed to the two consuls elect, it was declared that they were created by his sole authority. Their names and portraits, engraved on gilt tables of ivory, were dispersed over the empire as presents to the provinces, the cities, the magistrates, the senate, and the people. Their solemn inauguration was performed at the place of the imperial residence. And during a period of 120 years, Rome was constantly deprived of the presence of her ancient magistrates. On the morning of the 1st of January, the consuls assumed the ensigns of their dignity. Their dress was a robe of purple, embroidered in silk and gold, and sometimes ornamented with costly gems. On this solemn occasion they were attended by the most eminent officers of the state and army in the habit of senators, and the useless fasces, armed with the once formidable axes, were borne before them by the lictors. The procession moved from the palace to the forum, or principal square, of the city, where the consuls ascended their tribunal and seated themselves in the curule chairs, which were framed after the fashion of ancient times. They immediately exercised an act of jurisdiction by the manumission of a slave who was brought before them for that purpose, and the ceremony was intended to represent the celebrated action of the elder Brutus, the author of liberty and of the consulship, when he admitted among his fellow citizens the faithful Vindex, who had revealed the conspiracy of the Tarquins. The public festival was continued during several days in all the principal cities, in Rome from custom, in Constantinople from imitation, in Carthage, Antioch, and Alexandria from the love of pleasure and the superfluity of wealth. In the two capitals of the empire, the annual games of the theatre, the circus, and the amphitheatre cost £4,000 of gold, about £160,000 sterling. and did so heavy an expanse surpass the faculties or the inclinations of the magistrates themselves, the sum was supplied from the imperial treasury. As soon as the consuls had discharged these customary duties, they were at liberty to retire into the shade of private life, and to enjoy, during the remainder of the year, the undisturbed contemplation of their own greatness. They no longer presided in the national councils. They no longer executed the resolutions of peace or war. Their abilities, unless they were employed in more effective offices, were of little moment. Then their names served only as the legal date of the year in which they had filled the chair of Marius and of Cicero. Yet it was still felt and acknowledged in the last period of Roman servitude that this empty name might be compared, and even preferred, to the possession of substantial power. The title of consul was still the most splendid object of ambition, the noblest reward of virtue and loyalty. The emperors themselves, who disdained the faint shadow of the republic, were conscious that they acquired an additional splendour and majesty as often as they assumed the annual honours of the consular dignity. The proudest and most perfect separation which can be found in any age or country between the nobles and the people is perhaps that of the patricians and the plebeians, as it was established in the first age of the Roman Republic. Wealth and honours, the offices of the state, and the ceremonies of religion were almost exclusively possessed by the former, who, preserving the purity of their blood with the most insulting jealousy, held their clients in a condition of specious vassalage. But these distinctions, so incompatible with the spirit of a free people, were removed, after a long struggle, by the persevering efforts of the tribunes. The most active and successful of the plebeians accumulated wealth, aspired to honours, deserved triumphs, contracted alliances, and after some generations assumed the pride of ancient nobility. The patrician families, on the other hand, whose original number was never recruited till the end of the Commonwealth, either failed in the ordinary course of nature, or were extinguished in so many foreign and domestic wars, or, through a want of merit or fortune, insensibly mingled with the mass of the people. Very few remained who could derive their pure and genuine origin from the infancy of the city, or even from that of the Republic, when Caesar and Augustus, Claudius and Vespasian, created from the body of the Senate a competent number of new patrician families in the hope of perpetuating an order which was still considered as honourable and sacred. But these artificial supplies, in which the reigning house was always included, were rapidly swept away by the rage of tyrants, by frequent revolutions, by the change of manners, and by the intermixture of nations. Little more was left when Constantine ascended the throne than a vague and imperfect tradition that the patricians had once been the first of the Romans. To form a body of nobles whose influence may restrain, while it secures, the authority of the monarch, would have been very inconsistent with the character and policy of Constantine. But had he seriously entertained such a design, it might have exceeded the measure of his power to ratify, by an arbitrary edict, an institution which must expect the sanction of time and of opinion. He revived, indeed, the title of patricians, but he revived it as a personal, not as an hereditary distinction. They yielded only to the transient superiority of the annual consuls, but they enjoyed the preeminence over all the great officers of state, with the most familiar access to the person of the prince. This honourable rank was bestowed on them for life, and as they were usually favourites and ministers who had grown old in the imperial court, the true etymology of the word was perverted by ignorance and flattery, and the patricians of Constantine were reverenced as the adopted fathers of the emperor and the republic. The fortunes of the praetorian prefects were essentially different from those of the consuls and patricians. The latter saw their ancient greatness evaporate in a vain title. The former, rising by degrees from the most humble condition, were invested with the civil and military administration of the Roman world. From the reign of Severus to that of Diocletian, the guards and the palace, the laws and the finances, the armies and the provinces were entrusted to their superintending care, and like the viziers of the East, they held with one hand the seal and with the other the standard of the empire. The ambition of the prefects, always formidable and sometimes fatal to the masters whom they served, was supported by the strength of the praetorian bands. But after those haughty troops had been weakened by Diocletian and finally suppressed by Constantine, the prefects who survived their fall were reduced without difficulty to the station of useful and obedient ministers. When they were no longer responsible for the safety of the emperor's person, they resigned the jurisdiction which they had hitherto claimed and exercised over all the departments of the palace. They were deprived by Constantine of all military command as soon as they had ceased to lead into the field, under their immediate orders, the flower of the Roman troops. And at length, by singular revolution, the captains of the guards were transformed into the civil magistrates of the provinces. According to the plan of government instituted by Diocletian, the four princes had each their praetorian prefect, and after the monarchy was once more united in the person of Constantine, he still continued to create the same number of four prefects and entrusted to their care the same provinces which they already administered. The prefect of the East stretched his ample jurisdiction into the three parts of the globe which were subject to the Romans, from the cataracts of the Nile to the banks of the Phasis, and from the mountains of Thrace to the frontiers of Persia. The important provinces of Pannonia, Dacia, Macedonia, and Greece once acknowledged the authority of the prefect of Illyricum. The power of the prefect of Italy was not confined to the country from whence he derived his title. It extended over the additional territory of Rhaetia, as far as the banks of the Danube, over the dependent islands of the Mediterranean, and over that part of the continent of Africa which lies between the confines of Cyrene and those of Tingitania. The prefect of the Gauls comprehended under that plural denomination the kindred provinces of Britain and Spain, and his authority was obeyed from the wall of Antoninus to the foot of Mount Atlas. After the praetorian prefects had been dismissed from all military command, the civil functions which they were ordained to exercise over so many subject nations were adequate to the ambition and abilities of the most consummate ministers. To their wisdom was committed the supreme administration of justice and of the finances, the two objects which, in a state of peace, comprehend almost all the respective duties of the sovereign and of the people, of the former to protect the citizens who are obedient to the laws, of the latter to contribute the share of their property, which is required for the expenses of the state. The coin, the highways, the posts, the granaries, the manufactures, whatever could interest the public prosperity, was moderated by the authority of the praetorian prefects. As the immediate representatives of the imperial majesty, they were empowered to explain, to enforce, and on some occasions to modify the general edicts by their discretionary proclamations. They watched over the conduct of the provincial governors, removed the negligent, and inflicted punishment on the guilty. From all the inferior jurisdictions, an appeal in every matter of importance, either civil or criminal, might be brought before the tribunal of the prefect. But his sentence was final and absolute, and the emperors themselves refused to admit any complaints against the judgment or the integrity of a magistrate whom they honored with such unbounded confidence. His appointments were suitable to his dignity, and if avarice was his ruling passion, he enjoyed frequent opportunities of collecting a rich harvest of fees, of presents, and of perquisites. Though the emperors no longer dreaded the ambition of their prefects, they were attentive to counterbalance the power of this great office by the uncertainty and shortness of its duration. From their superior importance and dignity, Rome and Constantinople were alone excepted from the jurisdiction of the Praetorian prefects. The immense size of the city and the experience of the tardy, ineffectual operation of the laws had furnished the policy of Augustus with a specious pretense for introducing a new magistrate, who alone could restrain a servile and turbulent populace by the strong arm of arbitrary power. Valerius Messalla was appointed the first prefect of Rome, that his reputation might countenance so invidious a measure. But at the end of a few days, that accomplished citizen resigned his office, declaring with a spirit worthy of the friend of Brutus that he found himself incapable of exercising a power incompatible with public freedom. As the sense of liberty became less exquisite, the advantages of order were more clearly understood, and the prefect, who seemed to have been designed as a terror only to slaves and vagrants, was permitted to extend his civil and criminal jurisdiction over the equestrian and noble families of Rome. The praetors, annually created as the judges of law and equity, could not long dispute the possession of the forum with a vigorous and permanent magistrate, who was usually admitted into the confidence of the prince. Their courts were deserted. Their number, which had once fluctuated between 12 and 18, was gradually reduced to 2 or 3, and their important functions were confined to the expensive obligation of exhibiting games for the amusement of the people. After the office of the Roman consuls had been changed into a vain pageant, which was rarely displayed in the capital, the prefects assumed their vacant place in the Senate, and were soon acknowledged as the ordinary presidents of that venerable assembly. They received appeals from the distance of 100 miles, and it was allowed as a principle of jurisprudence that all municipal authority was derived from them alone. In the discharge of his laborious employment, the governor of Rome was assisted by 15 officers, some of whom had been originally his equals, or even his superiors. The principal departments were relative to the command of a numerous watch, established as a safeguard against fires, robberies, and nocturnal disorders. The custody and distribution of the public allowance of corn and provisions, the care of the port, of the aqueducts, of the common sewers, and of the navigation and bed of the Tiber, the inspection of the markets, the theatres, and of the private as well as the public works. Their vigilance ensured the 3 principal objects of a regular police, safety, plenty, and cleanliness, and as a proof of the attention of government to preserve the splendour and ornaments of the capital, a particular inspector was appointed for the statues, the guardian, as it were, of that inanimate people which, according to the extravagant computation of an old writer, was scarcely inferior in number to the living inhabitants of Rome. About 30 years after the foundation of Constantinople, a similar magistrate was created in that rising metropolis for the same uses and with the same powers. A perfect equality was established between the dignity of the 2 municipal and that of the 4 praetorian prefects. Those who, in the imperial hierarchy, were distinguished by the title of respectable, formed an intermediate class between the illustrious prefects and the honorable magistrates of the provinces. In this class, the proconsuls of Asia, Achaia, and Africa claimed a preeminence which was yielded to the remembrance of their ancient dignity, and the appeal from their tribunal to that of the prefects was almost the only mark of their dependence. But the civil government of the empire was distributed into 13 great dioceses, each of which equaled the just measure of a powerful kingdom. The first of these dioceses was subject to the jurisdiction of the Count of the East, and we may convey some idea of the importance and variety of his functions by observing that 600 apparitors, who would be styled at present either secretaries or clerks or ushers or messengers, were employed in his immediate office. The place of Augustal Prefect of Egypt was no longer filled by a Roman knight, but the name was retained, and the extraordinary powers which the situation of the country and the temper of the inhabitants had once made indispensable were still continued to the governor. The 11 remaining dioceses of Asiana, Pontica, and Thrace, of Macedonia, Dacia, and Pannonia, or Western Illyricum, of Italy and Africa, of Gaul, Spain, and Britain, were governed by 12 vicars or vice-prefects, whose name sufficiently explains the nature and dependence of their office. It may be added that the lieutenant generals of the Roman armies, the military counts and dukes who will be hereafter mentioned, were allowed the rank and title of respectable. As the spirit of jealousy and ostentation prevailed in the councils of the emperors, they proceeded with anxious diligence to divide the substance and to multiply the titles of power. The vast countries which the Roman conquerors had united under the same simple form of administration were imperceptibly crumbled into minute fragments, till at length the whole empire was distributed into 116 provinces, each of which supported an expensive and splendid establishment. Of these, 3 were governed by proconsuls, 37 by consulars, 5 by correctors, and 71 by presidents. The appellations of these magistrates were different. They ranked in successive order the ensigns of and their situation from accidental circumstances might be more or less agreeable or advantageous. But they were all, excepting only the proconsuls, alike included in the class of honorable persons. And they were alike entrusted during the pleasure of the prince and under the authority of the prefects or their deputies with the administration of justice and the finances in their respective districts. The ponderous volumes of the codes and pandects would furnish ample materials for a minute inquiry into the system of provincial government, as in the space of 6 centuries it was approved by the wisdom of the Roman statesmen and lawyers. For the preservation of peace and order, the governors of the provinces were armed with the sword of justice. They inflicted corporal punishments, and they exercised in capital offences the power of life and death. But they were not authorized to indulge the condemned criminal with the choice of his own execution, or to pronounce a sentence of the mildest and most honorable kind of exile. These prerogatives were reserved to the prefects, who alone could impose the heavy fine of 50 pounds of gold. Their vice-regents were confined to the trifling weight of a few ounces. This distinction, which seems to grant the larger, while it denies the smaller degree of authority, was founded on a very rational motive. The smaller degree was infinitely more liable to abuse. The passions of a provincial magistrate might frequently provoke him into acts of oppression, which affected only the freedom or the fortunes of the subject, though from a principle of prudence, perhaps of humanity, he might still be terrified by the guilt of innocent blood. It may likewise be considered that exile, considerable fines, or the choice of an easy death, relate more particularly to the rich and the noble than the persons most exposed to the avarice or resentment of a provincial magistrate were thus removed from his obscure persecution to the more august and impartial tribunal of the Praetorian Prefect. As it was reasonably apprehended that the integrity of the judge might be biased if his interest was concerned, or if his affections were engaged, the strictest regulations were established to exclude any person without the special dispensation of the emperor from the government of the province where he was born, and to prohibit the governor or his son from contracting marriage with a native or an inhabitant, or from purchasing slaves, lands, or houses within the extent of his jurisdiction. Notwithstanding these rigorous precautions, the Emperor Constantine, after a reign of 25 years, still deplores the venal and oppressive administration of justice, and expresses the warmest indignation that the audience of the judge, his dispatch of business, his seasonable delays, and his final sentence were publicly sold, either by himself or by the officers of his court. The continuance and perhaps the impunity of these crimes is attested by the repetition of impotent laws and ineffectual menaces. All the civil magistrates were drawn from the profession of the law. The celebrated institutes of Justinian are addressed to the youth of his dominions, who had devoted themselves to the study of Roman jurisprudence. And the sovereign condescends to animate their diligence by the assurance that their skill and ability would in time be rewarded by an adequate share in the government of the Republic. The rudiments of this lucrative science were taught in all the considerable cities of the East and West, but the most famous school was that of Berytus, on the coast of Phoenicia, which flourished above 3 centuries from the time of Alexander Severus, the author, perhaps, of an institution so advantageous to his native country. After a regular course of education which lasted 5 years, the students dispersed themselves through the provinces in search of fortune and honors. Nor could they want an inexhaustible supply of business in a great empire already corrupted by the multiplicity of laws, of arts, and of vices. The court of the Praetorian Prefect of the East could alone furnish employment for 150 advocates, 64 of whom were distinguished by peculiar privileges, and 2 were annually chosen with a salary of 60 pounds of gold to defend the causes of the treasury. The first experiment was made of their judicial talents by appointing them to act occasionally as assessors to the magistrates. From thence they were often raised to preside in the tribunals before which they had pleaded. They obtained the government of a province, and by the aid of merit, of reputation, or of favour, they ascended by successive steps to the illustrious dignities of the state. In the practice of the bar, these men had considered reason as the instrument of dispute. They interpreted the laws according to the dictates of private interest, and the same pernicious habits might still adhere to their characters in the public administration of the state. The honor of a liberal profession has indeed been vindicated by ancient and modern advocates who have filled the most important stations with pure integrity and consummate wisdom. But in the decline of Roman jurisprudence, the ordinary promotion of lawyers was pregnant with mischief and disgrace. The noble art, which had once been preserved as the sacred inheritance of the patricians, was fallen into the hands of freedmen and plebeians, who, with cunning rather than with skill, exercised a sordid and pernicious trade. Some of them procured admittance into families for the purpose of fomenting differences, of encouraging suits, and of preparing a harvest of gain for themselves or their brethren. Others, recluse in their chambers, maintained the dignity of legal professors by furnishing a rich client with subtleties to confound the plainest truths, and with arguments to color the most unjustifiable pretensions. The splendid and popular class was composed of the advocates, who filled the forum with the sound of their turgid and loquacious rhetoric. Careless of fame and of justice, they are described, for the most part, as ignorant and rapacious guides who conducted their clients through a maze of expense, of delay, and of disappointment. From whence, after a tedious series of years, they were at length dismissed when their patience and fortune were almost exhausted. In the system of policy introduced by Augustus, the governors, those at least of the imperial provinces, were invested with the full powers of the sovereign himself. Ministers of peace and war, the distribution of rewards and punishments depended on them alone, and they successively appeared on their tribunal in the robes of civil magistracy, and in complete armor at the head of the Roman legions. The influence of the revenue, the authority of law, and the command of a military force concurred to render their power supreme and absolute. And whenever they were tempted to violate their allegiance, the loyal province which they involved in their rebellion was scarcely sensible of any change in its political state. From the time of Commodus to the reign of Constantine, near 100 governors might be enumerated who, with various success, erected the standard of revolt, and though the innocent were too often sacrificed, the guilty might be sometimes prevented by the suspicious cruelty of their master. To secure his throne and the public tranquillity from these formidable servants, Constantine resolved to divide the military from the civil administration, and to establish as a permanent and professional distinction a practice which had been adopted only as an occasional expedient. The supreme jurisdiction exercised by the praetorian prefects over the armies of the empire was transferred to the two masters general whom he instituted, the one for the cavalry, the other for the infantry. And though each of these illustrious officers was more peculiarly responsible for the discipline of those troops which were under his immediate inspection, they both indifferently commanded in the field the several bodies, whether of horse or foot, which were united in the same army. Their number was soon doubled by the division of the East and West, and as separate generals of the same rank and title were appointed on the four important frontiers of the Rhine, of the Upper and the Lower Danube, and of the Euphrates, the defense of the Roman Empire was at length committed to eight masters general of the cavalry and infantry. Under their orders, 35 military commanders were stationed in the provinces, 3 in Britain, 6 in Gaul, 1 in Spain, 1 in Italy, 5 on the upper and 4 on the lower Danube, in Asia, 8, 3 in Egypt and 4 in Africa. The titles of counts and dukes, by which they were properly distinguished, have obtained in modern languages so very different a sense that the use of them may occasion some surprise. But it should be recollected that the second of those appellations is only a corruption of the Latin word, which was indiscriminately applied to any military chief. All these provincial generals were therefore dukes, but no more than 10 among them were dignified with the rank of counts or companions, a title of honor, or rather of favor, which had been recently invented in the court of Constantine. A gold belt was the ensign which distinguished the office of the counts and dukes, and besides their pay, they received a liberal allowance sufficient to maintain 190 servants and 158 horses. They were strictly prohibited from interfering in any matter which related to the administration of justice or the revenue. But the command which they exercised over the troops of their department was independent of the authority of the magistrates. About the same time that Constantine gave a legal sanction to the ecclesiastical order, he instituted in the Roman Empire the nice balance of the civil and the military powers. The emulation and sometimes the discord which reigned between two professions of opposite interests and incompatible manners was productive of beneficial and of pernicious consequences. It was seldom to be expected that the general and the civil governor of a province should either conspire for the disturbance or should unite for the service of their country. While the one delayed to offer the assistance which the other disdained to solicit, the troops very frequently remained without orders or without supplies. The public safety was betrayed, and the defenseless subjects were left exposed to the fury of the barbarians. The divided administration which had been formed by Constantine relaxed the vigor of the state, while it secured the tranquillity of the monarch. The memory of Constantine has been deservedly censured for another innovation which corrupted military discipline and prepared the ruin of the empire. The 19 years which preceded his final victory over Licinius had been a period of license and intestine war. The rivals who contended for the possession of the Roman world had withdrawn the greatest part of their forces from the guard of the general frontier, and the principal cities which formed the boundary of their respective dominions were filled with soldiers who considered their countrymen as their most implacable enemies. After the use of these internal garrisons had ceased with the civil war, the conqueror wanted either wisdom or firmness to revive the severe discipline of Diocletian, and to suppress a fatal indulgence which habit had endeared and almost confirmed to the military order. From the reign of Constantine, a popular and even legal